Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with an analysis of Donald Trump's much-heralded foreign policy that was supposed to be about foreign policy realism, but according to our first guest, Daniel Dresner, was really about Trumpism and should have realists clamoring for publicly distance themselves from Trump. A professor of international politics at Tufts University, Daniel Dresner joins us to discuss his latest article at the Washington Post, The Last Foreign Policy Letter That Needs to Be Written This Election Cycle. On top of today's letter by 100-plus Republican officials to the head of the RNC asking Reince Priebus to dump Trump, we will look into the series of letters signed by foreign policy experts so far who see Hillary Clinton as a flawed but superior choice for president, even though many realists have argued that her liberal interventionist foreign policy has damaged U.S. interests. Then we'll speak with Nada Hashemi, the director of the Center for Middle East Studies at the University of Denver and author of The Syria Dilemma, about Russia's use of an airbase in Iran and the growing cooperation between the two countries led by staunchly anti-American leaders who are resolutely committed to keeping the Assad regime in power in Syria. We'll explore the paradox that the U.S. is poised to, in effect, join the Russian-Iranian initiative in the hope of getting Assad to sign onto a peace deal that many in Washington, including the Secretary of Defense, oppose. Then finally, we'll examine a new report by the Institute for Policy Studies, The Ever-Growing Gap, failing to address the status quo will drive the racial wealth divide for centuries to come. An author of the report, Chuck Collins, a senior scholar at APS, IPS and the co-founder of the Patriotic Millionaires, joins us to discuss how over the past 30 years, the average wealth of white families in America has grown by 84%, 1.2 times the rate for Latinos and 3 times the rate of growth for the black population. And joining us now is Daniel Dresner, who's a professor of international politics at Tufts University and a non-resident senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. He has an op-ed at the Washington Post, The Last Foreign Policy Letter That Needs to Be Written This Election Cycle. Welcome to Background Briefing, Daniel Dresner.
Thanks for having me.
And it does seem like there's a pile-on going on here, given that today 100-plus Republican officials sent a letter to the head of the DNC, Reince Priebus, asking him to dump Trump. But, of course, you're referring to this series of foreign policy letters by groups of experts so far. And how, in terms of U.S. foreign policy, the realists, who would be the exemplar? Brent Scowcroft?
Brent Scowcroft would certainly be an example of a realist. Among the academy, people like John Mearsheimer or Steve Walt would be considered realists. Henry Kissinger, a lot of people would consider a realist. People who publish in the Journal of the National Interest are generally thought to be associated with realism. There are others that I could name.
Well, and in terms of the neoconservatives who don't like Trump but support Hillary Clinton, or at least some of them do, they're more or less sort of reckless utopians, aren't they? Would they be the opposite of realists?
Well, realism and neoconservatism certainly disagree on a few things. Realists generally are very skeptical about the use of force overseas by the United States. They generally think that the United States should reserve its military capabilities for only important and sort of strategic and vital interests, and that we should be primarily focused on threats from the great powers. Neoconservatives are more likely to see existential threats under every rock they can look at. And so they see the Middle East as a scary cauldron in which provokes, you know, radical Islamic terrorism, and they think that it is worth trying to use American force as a way of, taking care of certain elements in the Middle East. So in that sense, you can argue that neoconservatives disagree with Trump because Trump has at times talked about the United States being too reckless abroad. But realists, to be fair, also have their disagreements with Trump. Trump has also talked about the futility of NATO and that it would be worth rethinking alliances with key allies like Japan and South Korea as well. And Trump has also talked about sort of flagrant violations of international law, like bombing the families of terrorists and so on and so forth. So to be fair, realists don't necessarily agree all that much with Trump either.
Well, do you think, though, there's any point in trying to find some consistency or rationality in Trump's foreign policy or in any of his policies so far? It seems that this is a very, shall I say, troubled candidate. Some people question his mental faculties.
Light way of putting it. I think there are a number of issues where Donald Trump, frankly, has no idea what he's talking about when he talks about foreign policy. That said, my colleague at Brookings, Tom Wright, wrote a wonderful essay in Politico back in January talking about one area where Trump actually has been consistent over the decades, which is he really does sort of believe in a mercantilist approach to the world, in a zero-sum approach in terms of economics. So, you know, going back to the 1980s, Donald Trump thought that the United States was losing to Japan in terms of trade. And he still thinks that we're losing to Japan in terms of trade. And now what he's done is simply add China to it as well. And in some ways, that kind of zero-sum lens also infects how he thinks about world politics, which is why he talks about whether or not our NATO allies are contributing enough to the alliance and so forth. So in that sense, I think it would be safe to say that Donald Trump has a coherent worldview, even though he doesn't know that much about world politics.
Well, he certainly, his campaign chairman, of course, is a lobbyist, Paul Manafort, who brings some foreign policy experience in as much as he was the sort of, apparently the bag man, as well as the campaign director for Yanukovych, the ousted Ukrainian kleptocrat, which provoked the war between Russia and Ukraine. And frankly, I talked on Sunday to an independent defense analyst in Moscow, Dr. Pavel Felgenhauer, who writes for Novaya Gazeta, which is one of the few, if almost the only, newspapers not controlled by the Kremlin, because Gorbachev has a stake in it. And he actually was saying there's at least a 50-50 chance that this confrontation on the de facto border between Crimea and Ukraine could turn into a real war. So I asked him, I said, well, is that going to help Trump? And he said, probably will, because Trump has painted Obama as being feckless on Russian foreign policy, not to mention not going after ISIS in a robust and manly way. So is it possible that some of these external wild cards in foreign policy, like an ISIS attack on the homeland or an escalation between Russia and Ukraine, could help Trump, even though he doesn't have a grasp on foreign policy?
I'm somewhat dubious of this. I mean, I see what you're saying, and it's certainly a possibility, but it's worth remembering that when there were a spate of terrorist attacks in late May and early June, you know, everyone thought that was actually going to benefit Donald Trump, and in fact, the reverse happened. He actually lost support during that period. So I would be suspicious that another crisis would cause Trump to necessarily benefit, because his tendency when this happens is to shoot from the hip, is to say something that's relatively stupid, and then it's usually easy to call him out on it. The possibility of an ISIS attack in the United States would probably be the one that you would think would increase the likelihood the most of Trump's support. But that said, it's worth pointing out that almost every public opinion poll that has asked questions about who do you trust in terms of foreign policy and who do you trust in terms of temperament to be president, Hillary Clinton crushes Donald Trump on those questions. And that's important because in some ways, during a crisis, that's exactly when you want a president with an even keel. And if there is one thing that Donald Trump does not project, it's an even keel.
Well, you have to admit that Hillary Clinton's got to be awfully lucky to have this fellow to run against if he's self-destructing on the trajectory that he appears to be on, and she was not entirely popular herself. But it is still extraordinary to think that the Republican Party is depending upon, in effect, for their guy to win. Basically, they're counting on the Russians and Julian Assange.
It's certainly, yes, if you had told me a year ago that the GOP was going to be saying nice things about Vladimir Putin and Julian Assange, I don't think I would have believed it. And in some ways, one of the interesting things about Trump's candidacy is watching other Republicans who have committed themselves to Trump but have obviously not said nice things about Vladimir Putin or WikiLeaks, having to sort of slowly torture themselves, twist their words in a way so they can simultaneously support Trump but also say they've been consistent with their values.
So just in the last couple of minutes, Daniel Drasner, is there, you think, this deal in Syria that the U.S. might sign on to, they appear to be poised to do so, does it end Russia's bombing now using bases in Iran and they're stepping up their efforts in Syria? Does this having to do with the idea that if Hillary Clinton comes along, she's going to be more interventionist than Barack Obama, and the Russians, the Iranians, and Assad wanted consolidate their position before she comes along?
That would certainly be a factor at play. There's no doubt that as foreign leaders look and try to gauge at who's going to be the next president, if it's Hillary Clinton, particularly in the Middle East, she's much more likely to be more hawkish. So if they can lock in certain policies or certain outcomes on the ground now before she takes over in January 2017, this would certainly give them an incentive to try to cut the deals.
And in terms of Putin and his so-called bromance with Trump, you wonder why he's so openly intervening in the election, because Trump's not doing that well. You think he'd be more of a realist in that regard. But I'm hearing from Moscow as well that maybe Trump is too unpredictable, even for Putin.
Yeah, I'm not sure Putin is really going to be intervening all that much going forward in the U.S. election. As you say, he's been, he said nice things about Donald Trump, but he's also, tried to distance himself at times. And to the extent to which he gets good advice on who's likely to win the election in November, he will probably not want to completely alienate Hillary Clinton. That said, it should be pointed out that Vladimir Putin does not get along well at all with Hillary Clinton. He blames her for, among other things, the protests that broke out when Putin announced that he would succeed Dmitry Medvedev as the Russian president, and blamed Clinton for inciting those kinds of protests. And so that'll leave a nasty residue.
Right, and she said quite publicly that Putin doesn't have a soul, which I don't think endeared him to her. Well, thank you, Daniel Drasner. I appreciate your time.
No problem. Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Daniel Drasner, who's a professor of international politics at Tufts University and a non-resident senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. He has an op-ed at the Washington Post, the last foreign policy letter that needs to be written this election cycle. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into Russia's use of an airbase in Iran and the growing cooperation between the two countries.
Oh, no. Oh, well, I ain't going to study war no more. Ain't going to study war no more. Ain't going to study war no more. Yes, war no more. Well, I ain't going to study war no more. Ain't gonna study war no more. Ain't gonna study war no more. Gonna lay down my hymn book down by the riverside. Down by the riverside.
ضحك علي بعيونه منور نظرة رماني. من ضحك علي منور نظرة رماني. جيت اني بجوز عيونه حارس مار الحنطاوي
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Nada Hashemi, who is the director of the Center for Middle East Studies at the Joseph Corbell School of International Studies at the University of Denver. He is the author of The People Reloaded, The Green Movement and the Struggle for Iran's Future. And his latest book is The Syria Dilemma. Welcome to Background Briefing, Nada Hashemi.
Thanks, Ian.
And what do you make of the Russian deployment of long-range bombers, the so-called backfire bombers, from an airbase in Hamadan, northwest Iran? They've been taking off now, along with fighter escorts, to bomb Syria. This cuts their flight time by 60%. They used to have to fly in from Russia, and now, of course, because they're closer, they can carry bigger payloads. And my understanding is that what's really significant about this is that Iran has never allowed foreign countries to base their militaries on Iranian soil, not even under the Shah. So that in itself appears to be significant, even if the deployment of these bombers is a part of an escalating pattern in the war in Syria.
Well, I think from Iran's perspective, this recent news story highlights what we already know, and that is Iran is deeply and heavily invested in the conflict in Syria. It views its entire national security doctrine as dependent on the outcome of that war, ensuring that the Assad regime remains in power. And so it's more than willing to accommodate and coordinate policy with Russia, which it already has been doing since the beginning of the conflict, but much more intensively and seriously over the last 8 to 9 months when Russia intervened militarily in Syria. And so I think this, you know, from Iran's perspective, it simply reaffirms its deep investments and interests in Syria. But I think there's also, you know, a couple of other things that are going on here that your listeners should be aware of. Number one, I think this news story about Russian bombers leaving Iranian air bases highlights that we are headed for an intensification of the conflict in Syria and an intensification of a Russian air involvement in the conflict in Syria. And I think part of the calculation here from Russia and Iran's perspective is the clock is not on Russia and Iran's side with respect to this conflict in Syria. The big concern that they have is that Hillary Clinton might come to office in the next several months, and she has at least publicly stated that she wants to change U.S. policy with respect to Syria and get more involved militarily in the context of a possible safe haven, creating safe zones or an air exclusion zone. So I think the Russians and the Iranians know that, and they're trying to resolve the conflict in Syria in their favor before Hillary Clinton comes to power. The other thing that's happening that's much more direct and immediate is that over the last month and a half, the United States and Russia have been trying to coordinate their policies on Syria. And we are on the verge of an announcement that I suspect might come within the next couple of days, where the United States and Russia will announce a joint coordinated plan of action to militarily take the war both to ISIS and to Al-Qaeda in Syria. And that's going to involve, you know, direct military and intelligence sharing and an intensification of a bombing campaign against those extremist Islamist elements in Syria. You know, the deal from the American perspective is that they hope by coordinating with Russia that they can facilitate a peace process, that if Russia and the United States coordinate military action in Syria, that would be based on a certain quid pro quo. The United States would provide intelligence sharing with Russia. The United States will help coordinate bombing campaigns against ISIS and Al-Qaeda, in this case Jabhat al-Nusra, which is one of the key rebel groups fighting Assad, particularly in Aleppo. And in exchange, the Russians are supposed to press Assad to ground its air force and to be much more forthcoming in terms of negotiating a political solution for this conflict that has lasted 5 years. So I think those are some of the background developments that are taking place here.
Well, in the current battle over Aleppo, in spite of Russian air power, in spite of Iran's proxies, Hezbollah being used, and I believe elements of the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps on the ground, the rebels seem to be doing well. They beat back the Syrian army just recently, and, you know, the siege, they weren't Russians, Iranians, and the Assad regime weren't able to seal off Aleppo and put it under siege. So what explains that?
Well, I think we have to be careful not to read too much into these recent developments. Yes, the rebels were able to, in Aleppo, were able to break out of the siege, but that doesn't mean the conflict in Syria or Aleppo is over. They're still basically the rebels in Aleppo are still in a very precarious situation. They still are effectively surrounded. They were able to break out of the siege that looked like it was about to sort of strangle the rebels in eastern Aleppo, but I think that's simply a temporary victory for rebel forces in Syria. So I don't buy any. I don't think anyone should read this as a game changer in terms of the status of battlefield conditions between the multiplicity of rebel forces that exist on the one side and Assad on the other, backed by Russia and Iran. I think we're still in a situation where this conflict is going to drag on for some time to come until there is fundamentally a political settlement within Syria. So I don't read recent developments that have shifted somewhat in the rebel side as a decided game changer. I think that would be a misreading of what the actual battlefield conditions in Aleppo suggest. I think the big development that everyone is waiting for is this proposed plan and coordinated intelligence and military sharing between the United States and Russia, which just I just checked the Reuters feed about an hour ago, and there was an update that John Kerry had phoned his counterpart Lavrov in Moscow today to sort of discuss putting more details on the plan that is about to be, I think, announced perhaps any day now, that would result in an intensification of the bombing campaign in Syria by both of the two great powers. And the big concern here, at least from the rebel perspective, is that is this bombing campaign going to result in a situation where the status of Aleppo will change in favor of the Assad regime? Because one of the main rebel groups in Aleppo that was responsible for the recent breaking out of the siege and the recent defeat of Assad's forces is the Jabhat al-Nusra al-Qaeda affiliate in Syria, which is technically an offshoot of al-Qaeda in the Pakistani Afghan region. It's basically they have sworn allegiance to Ayman al-Zawahiri, although recently they announced that they were no longer allied with al-Qaeda, and now they're more independent. But still, I think the big concern here for the future of the conflict in Syria is that if the ISIS affiliate in Syria, Jabhat al-Nusra, is going to be subjected to intensification of a military campaign, both by Russia and by the United States, that could mean a significant shift in the war in Syria, because they are one of the main rebel groups, and they have played a very significant role in terms of breaking out of this siege of Aleppo, and that could actually have consequences for the future of the conflict as a whole in Syria, which is one reason why I think Russia is so interested in coordinating with the United States, because I think they're calculating that if Jabhat al-Nusra can be peeled off or crushed and removed from the conflict in Syria, the remaining Syrian rebel groups will not have the military ability to resist the Assad regime, and perhaps the conflict will shift in a more significant way, much more quickly, in Russia and in Iran's direction.
And again, I'm speaking with Nada Hashemi, who is the director of the Center for Middle East Studies at the Joseph Corbell School of International Studies at the University of Denver. He's the author of The People Reloaded, The Green Movement and the Struggle for Iran's Future. And his latest book is The Syria Dilemma. Well, this deal that is being cooked up between Kerry and Lavrov, between the U.S. and Russia, when you say that it may lead to Assad being more flexible, he has shown absolutely the opposite. The more the Russians and the Iranians help him, the more he digs in and basically says it's either me or the terrorists, and that's what he's been saying since day one. So, and I also recall that when Russia first started putting its military into Syria, Obama more or less said to Putin, welcome to the quagmire. So what's going on there behind the scenes? Because there's a significant buildup going on the de facto border between Crimea and Ukraine. And there, I talked to a Russian military specialist on Sunday who thought that there's a 50-50 chance of a real war breaking out there. That would obviously complicate this deal. So what's your sense on this maneuvering going on? Because it looks as if Obama has decided the only way to end the agony in Syria is to basically give in to the Russians and the Iranians with some kind of, some patina of American approval.
That's basically correct. I think the big question mark here that no one knows, and I think will soon be revealed, is if this Russian and American deal goes through, will Russia be willing and able to pressure Assad to ground its air force and then to compromise in terms of working towards a political solution to the conflict in Syria? That's why within the United States, particularly within the Pentagon and the U.S. intelligence services and segments of the State Department, there's quite a bit of skepticism that this deal that's being negotiated and is about to be announced is based on a fundamental flaw that you can somehow trust Vladimir Putin to live up to his end of the bargain. Now, I think what's going on here is, you know, we are in the last few months of the Obama administration. The Obama administration has basically taken a position that they don't want to get any further involved in Syria, particularly with respect to discussing the core of the conflict, the future of Syria, the question of a political transition. Obama doesn't want to get any further involved. He doesn't want to risk, you know, getting sucked into a quagmire. And I think he's just running out the clock here. The real question is what will happen if Hillary Clinton gets elected, and whether she will follow through with her stated position that she wants to get more militarily involved in Syria. She wants to have greater leverage to push forward U.S. policy and to try and reach a political compromise. And you're right. I think your question sort of hints at the fact that right now Russia is in the driver's seat, Iran is in the driver's seat, and there's no expectation that after 5 years of war, Russia is going to simply capitulate. Because they've coordinated military and intelligence sharing with the United States. I think the Russians and the Iranians are much more savvy than that. They realize that things could change dramatically in a negative direction should Hillary Clinton come to power, and they're trying to take advantage of every opportunity that exists here to advance their position. And Assad is feeling emboldened. Right now, you know, I think he's looking much better than he did exactly a year ago. And the prediction and the calculation that you just hinted at, that when Russia got involved militarily in Syria last September with its major deployment of its air force, President Obama, you know, predicted that Russia would get bogged down in a quagmire, exactly sort of fearing what the United States would be facing if they got involved. But there was a recent military assessment of Russia's position by U.S. intelligence services vis-a-vis the conflict in Syria, and actually the calculation was the exact opposite. Russia has actually played its cards very carefully. They haven't been bogged down. They haven't been losing aircraft or personnel, and they have actually been able to advance their position much more, I think, significantly than the Americans have. And I think that largely explains why you know, they are willing to sort of negotiate with the Americans over greater intelligence sharing and military coordination, because they feel that they will benefit from that situation. So I don't see any particular game changer, any significant change in the conflict in Syria anytime soon. I think the Russians are hoping that with the help of Iranian ground forces and other sort of Shia militias that have been recruited across the Muslim world, that they can perhaps end the conflict in Aleppo over the next several months before Hillary Clinton comes to power. And then that would mean essentially a very different set of battlefield conditions in Syria when a new president assumes office in the United States. Because if you capture Aleppo, that effectively means, at least from a psychological perspective, that the conflict will be over in a sense, and Assad will be looking very strong. So I think those are some of the calculations and the questions that emerge, at least in my mind, looking forward in terms of how this conflict is playing itself out. And I think a lot of this really revolves around the future of Aleppo, whether Russia and Iran can advance their interests, can conquer the eastern part of the city, can destroy the rebel stronghold that exists there. And if they do, then I think we're looking at a very different situation in Syria than existed just a few months ago.
Well, in the last couple of minutes then, Nader Hashemi, let's turn to Iran and Russia and the portent of... There's been an informal kind of anti-American alliance between Russia, China and Iran. They've met informally on a number of occasions, their heads. There's no question that Iran is the most, probably the most anti-American regime, at least the supreme leaders. It's obviously a bifurcated regime, with the president being less hostile than the supreme leader. And the supreme leader, of course, controls the levers of power, the Revolutionary Guard Corps and the militias that keep people in line. So is there anything to that possibility that alliance could grow? We know that Putin is sort of obsessively anti-American, or at least he believes that America's behind all of the problems he faces. So is there any possibility of a deepening? And there's no question that Xi Jinping in China is getting more assertive as well. Whether this is because they think the Americans need to back off from their imperial power, or whether they feel it's their day in the sun. I don't know whether that's China's position, but I'm more familiar with Russia's position, and you're certainly more familiar with Iran's position.
Well, I think you're correct. I think the news today that sort of sparked this conversation between the two of us of Russia using Iranian airfields in western Iran to bomb Syria suggests precisely deeper coordination and collaboration between Moscow and Tehran over Middle East policy. Now, I think on Syria, there is a convergence, at least in the short term, between Russia and Iran over preserving the Assad regime, making sure that the rebels are defeated. Whether that extends to other parts of the world, I think, remains to be seen. But I think at a broad level, both Russia and the Islamic Republic of Iran, you know, are motivated both ideologically and politically by challenging and pushing back against U.S. foreign policy in all of these zones of conflict. Whether Iran can offer anything to Russia in terms of its confrontation with the West over Crimea and Ukraine, I think there's very little that Iran has to offer in those theaters of conflict. But with respect to the Middle East and respect to really the question of Syria, which is at the heart of the instability of the Middle East, that has now, you know, destabilized not only the Middle East, but now has had ripple effects in Europe and in the United States, and then led to, you know, all types of unintended consequences on that particular issue. Russia and Iran are basically reading from the same playbook. Where they differ and when they might differ remains to be seen. There is some debate that Russia and Iran do have different visions for the future of Syria, that Iran is much more invested in the House of Assad and in the Ba'ath Party staying in power, while Russia is simply using Syria more of as a bargaining chip to pressure the Americans and to pressure the Western Europeans in terms of the rules of the international game, and that perhaps Russia might be willing to, you know, bargain away or sort of coordinate policy with the United States in ways that would challenge and clash with Iran's fundamental visions over the future of Syria if it was to Putin's advantage. Because I think from Putin's perspective, I think he's really using Syria as a test case, as a laboratory, to really send a message to the United States that, look, Russia is now a major power. The United States and its allies can't unilaterally decide which regimes in the world survive and which regimes are toppled. And they're going to invest, you know, heavily in Syria as a way of sending a message that, you know, Russia now has interests on a global level. And so in that sense, I think there is some deep differences between Tehran and Moscow that might come to a head at some point down the road. But I think we're still a long way away from seeing that option play itself out.
And just a quick comment on the status of the deal with Iran that Donald Trump is hammering away at, saying it's a terrible deal. I think the average American is beginning to wonder whether it was such a good deal. And it does seem to me the supreme leader and his people are doing everything they can to sabotage the deal, even though they went along with it. And the neocons on our side are doing everything they can to sabotage the deal. So just a quick assessment of whether that deal was worth it, and what's the status of the deal?
Well, I think the deal is still worth it for the arguments and the reasons that were advanced over the last 2 or 3 years. Without the deal, we most likely would have had perhaps another war breaking out in the Middle East, this time over the question of Iran's nuclear program. I mean, the big benefits of the deal is that it prevents another war from taking place in the Middle East. And so in that sense, the deal is, I think, a net gain for the region. And this is, the assessment of where the deal stands a year after it was actually signed all points to full implementation, both by the Iranians and by the Americans. Even the Israeli intelligence services have sort of acknowledged that Iran has lived up to its own end of the bargain that it signed and the agreement that it signed in Vienna last summer. So the deal moves forward, and on the Iranian side, there's a lot of griping and complaints that the economic benefits that Iran was hoping would flow their way haven't materialized, and that the promises that the West allegedly made to Iran, that they haven't lived up to those promises. And the Supreme Leader and the hardliners are using this as an excuse really to reinforce a narrative that they've been utilizing from the beginning of the Islamic Revolution in Iran 37 years ago, that the West can't be trusted, that the United States signs agreements but doesn't live up to them. But I think the reason why the material benefits and the economic situation in Iran has not improved has to do with simply a different set of issues, that investors and foreign companies don't have confidence that, Iran is a stable country to invest in. There's also fear that the U.S. Congress could slap sort of secondary sanctions on U.S. companies, and the President of the United States has no control or say over what a Republican-controlled Congress can do with respect to, sanctions on Iran. So the deal, I think, overall still is a net gain for the region, largely because it prevents another war from breaking out. And so it moves forward. And I suspect if Hillary Clinton gets elected again, the agreement will still sort of continue based on the agreements that were signed. And so I don't think the criticism that you're still hearing from the Republicans and from Donald Trump is simply because they're not interested in the facts. They're not interested in nuclear agreement. They're interested in going to war with Iran. So that's why they were opposed to the agreement when it was being negotiated, and they oppose the agreement right now. So I don't think we need to, I think, take their protestations very seriously, because all indications, most importantly, the International Atomic Energy Agency, which oversees this agreement, has said that Iran has been living up to its commitments and has scaled back its nuclear program, and it's now under full international inspection.
Well, thank you very much for joining us here today, Nada Hashemi.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Nada Hashemi, who's the director of the Center for Middle East Studies at the Joseph Corbell School of International Studies at the University of Denver. He's the author of The People Reloaded, The Green Movement, and The Struggle for Iran's Future. And his latest book is The Syria Dilemma. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back examining the growing racial wealth gap. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Chuck Collins, who's a senior scholar at the Institute for Policy Studies, where he directs IPS's program on inequality and the common good, as well as co-founder of Wealth for the Common Good and the Patriotic Millionaires. His latest book is 99-1, How Wealth Inequality is Wrecking the World and What We Can Do About It. And he has a new report at the Institute for Policy Studies, The Ever-Growing Gap, Failing to Address the Status Quo Will Drive the Racial Wealth Divide for Centuries to Come. Welcome to Background Briefing, Chuck Collins.
Great to be with you, Ian.
Well, unfortunately, the news you're delivering here is quite alarming, and we are all aware of the growing income divide in this country. And, of course, the 99-1 framework has become sort of the enduring legacy of the Occupy movement. but I don't think the public is quite aware of what your new report's about, which is the growing racial wealth divide. And this report examines our country's growing racial wealth divide and the trajectory of that divide, and it's pretty alarming.
Yeah, you know, I think it's growing, the awareness is growing about overall inequality, and what I would say is that that inequality has kind of supercharged this historic racial wealth gap. So we've looked at the last 30 years, and, you know, there was modest increases in growth of black wealth and Latino wealth, but during this period, white wealth has taken off. And so, as you say, the trajectory, if we just stay on autopilot, it will take centuries for black wealth, at the rate that it's been growing, to catch up with even where white wealth is today. We estimate 228 years for black wealth to catch up to where white wealth is today, and 84 years for Latino wealth to catch up. And that's just a way to sort of dramatize just how slowly the gap is closing.
But is the run-up in white wealth a result of the broader income divide that we're talking about, the 1% of the 1% who have been largely the beneficiaries of the last 20 or 30 years? And I imagine that most of the billionaires in this country and certainly the top corporate people are white.
Yeah, you know, Thomas Piketty, the French economist, said, you know, we're moving toward a hereditary aristocracy of wealth. What he didn't say is that aristocracy would be largely white. And I kind of think, you know, if you think these inequalities have really taken off since the late 70s, early 80s, but the racial wealth divide, which has been, you know, has a longer legacy, but even just looking after World War II, you know, say after 1945, that's when we as a country made a massive investment in broadening home ownership and primarily helped white households get on the asset-building express train, the wealth-building express train, whereas because of the legacy of discrimination or actual discrimination, people of color did not get on that wealth-building train. So lo and behold, two generations later, we have an enormous gap in wealth and home ownership, just for one explanation.
Well, but I think some of that surely can be attributed to the 2008 crash, because I recall that that when all of those toxic mortgages went out, what are referred to as liar's loans, and that so many of the people who were victimized were aspirants to the middle class from minority communities, and they were the ones that bought into these incredibly deceptive mortgages, and you know, they suddenly went from owning a home into living in their cars.
Yeah, I mean, the I would call that sort of the wealth stripping or asset theft that took place as part of the economic meltdown and the subprime mortgage crisis. And one of the trends here is that white wealth has rebounded more quickly than black wealth, because most of black wealth is in home ownership. Most of Latino wealth is in home ownership, whereas white wealth is more diversified in home ownership and other financial assets, which tended to recover faster than home values.
So just to state the bare and stark statistics here, over the past 30 years, the average wealth of white families has grown by 84%, 1.2 times the rate of growth for the Latino population and 3 times the rate of growth for the black population. And by 2043, the year in which it's projected that people of color will make up a majority of U.S. populations, the wealth divide between white families and Latino and black families will have doubled on an average from 500,000 in 2013 to over 1 million. So this is a pretty shameful situation. Now, I guess you mentioned a bit ago about how there's an historical legacy, of course, from going back from slavery. And in terms of Latino population, a lot of Latinos have arrived here at the border pretty much penniless, but they've done better. Is there? And then you have the Asian population as well, and it's often characterized in sort of racial terms that certain groups do better than others. So how do you navigate those statistics between the Latinos, the African-Americans, and the Asians?
just on Asians, we have very little longer-term data on Asian wealth, and because very different ethnic experiences are grouped together under the Asian race. So you have Southeast Asian, Cambodians, Vietnamese, and others who are on the very low wealth end of things, and then you have sort of Japanese, Chinese, Korean wealth taking off differently. So we don't have a very coherent story about Asian wealth. Some segments of Asians are actually growing faster than white wealth, and some are not. I think in the case of black wealth, we're just talking about a deeper historic legacy of discrimination and asset building that goes right up to the present. Similarly with Latinos and the Chicano experience in California, people were not able to get mortgages because of the color of their skin and still face the situation where assets in home ownership in communities of color does not rise or appreciate at the same rate as white neighborhoods. So those are some of the factors that keep that racial wealth divide in place.
And again, I'm speaking with Chuck Collins, who's a senior scholar at the Institute for Policy Studies, where he directs his IPS's program on inequality and the common good, as well as co-founder of Wealth for the Common Good and the Patriotic Millionaires. His latest book is 99-1, How Wealth Inequality is Wrecking the World and What We Can Do About It. And he has a new report at the Institute for Policy Studies, The Ever-Growing Gap, Failing to Address the Status Quo Will Drive the Racial Wealth Divide for Centuries to Come. So I guess this sort of flies in the face of this idea of the U.S. being a meritocracy and the Horatio Alger kind of myth. Do you see this report and the unpleasant realities that you brought to the table as sort of fixed in stone?
No, I don't. One thing that gives me hope or possibility is between 1945 and 1965, we, as a nation, decided to change the wealth ownership dynamics through, very deliberate investments. And in a generation, we built 25% of the population moved from tenancy to home ownership, primarily white. So any trajectory you can change, it's like shooting an arrow. If you just move that trajectory a little bit, It doesn't have to be as off target, and in our report we argue that the first place to start is looking at the massive subsidies that already go into wealth creation, whether it's encouraging home ownership through the home mortgage interest deduction, or encouraging retirement funds through, tax incentives and tax incentive in individual retirement accounts. Those are expensive. I mean, we spent as a country $660 billion last year encouraging private wealth building. Most of that money went to the already have a lot of money people, went to the wealthy who don't need subsidies to help them build more wealth. And we think you could redirect that to focus on those who've been excluded historically from wealth building efforts.
And how much, though, does at the end of the day, it's often been argued that our tax system is the kind of DNA of our society. And it's clear that over the recent decades, the wealthy have paid less and less. If you go back to Dwight David Eisenhower in 1952, the richest Americans were paying 92% tax. Now, is it 39%, I think it is, or 30. What's the
39% is the top tax rate, the effective rate that group pays is closer to 30, or it's below 30%.
Right.
And part of it is these loopholes. Last year, 2015, looking just at these tax expenditures, what I call the upside down tax subsidies, millionaires got an average tax break of $145,000. And someone, a household with an income of $50,000, got $174. So if we just said, look, you already have two mansions, we're not going to give you tax breaks for large houses over a certain size of interest deduction, and we're going to reroute those subsidies to encourage first-time homebuyers or people who have no savings to have matching savings accounts and the sort of things that we did after World War II to help build a white middle class.
But it seems that we mentioned how Wall Street essentially stripped the wealth of the of people who were aspiring to join the middle class from minority communities. But it does seem that this is fairly systemic, isn't it? Because there is nowhere for working and middle class Americans to save. I mean, most people can't save because they simply need every spend every dollar they can on food and gas, etc. But you know, we don't have pensions anymore that are guaranteed. Everybody has to put their money in the stock market. In Japan, for example, they have post office savings. Bernie Sanders has tried to bring back post office savings here, as at the same time revive the post offices themselves. So I've often wondered why it is a progressive, and if not that Bernie Sanders has gotten elected, but Hillary Clinton is supposedly taking on some of his progressive ideas. Why can't we have in this country a kind of what they had during World War II, sort of savings bonds for average people so that they don't have to be at the vagaries of the stock market, which their pensions are? And presumably if you can save some money, then you can buy a house or put a deposit on a house.
Well, I think the idea you mentioned, Ian, post office banking, the idea of public banks that are again, outside Wall Street pressure. There's a whole sort of people's economic banking initiative that should be central to a progressive agenda. And it's true, if you're not able to earn a living wage, you're obviously not saving anything above and beyond your expenses. You may be going deeper into debt. So anything that both raises wages and provides incentives and support for saving will greatly equalize this situation. And those aren't necessarily racially tied initiatives. Those are things that, can be encouraged for people below a certain income. And again, people think, oh, you're talking about subsidizing people today. We subsidized to enormous levels, some $8 trillion over the decade after World War II, 1945 to 1955. We spent a lot of money investing and subsidizing the creation of a white middle class. It didn't just happen by accident, and it didn't happen just by some people working hard. We, as a society, oriented the rules to encourage that. And that's exactly the same attitude we should take toward fixing this in the future.
Well, it used to be that banks paid interest. Now they charge interest, since most people are borrowing on their credit cards. So the whole system has been turned on its head. Tell me, though, about some of the recommendations here, one of which is to conduct an evidence-based government-wide audit of federal policies to understand the role current policies play in perpetuating the racial wealth divide. That's something you think that's a sort of base that you need to establish to, what, name and shame the Congress into start representing the American people instead of the 1%?
Well, I think it's partly a recognition that even people of goodwill and intent will say, well, here's the public policies that we think will reduce the racial wealth divide. Let's expand home ownership. Let's expand, well, for the reasons you and I have talked about, there's a whole predatory lending industry around home ownership. Homes don't appreciate at the same rate in communities of color. In some cases, just having stable, nonprofit-owned, well-managed housing may be a better way for people to build savings and wealth than owning a home. So having an audit, having a body or policies are that just says, let's look at each policy and whether it's worsening the racial wealth gap or closing it, and not just assume that everything we do to reduce inequality will also reduce the wealth disparities between races.
And another recommendation in your report, Chuck, is to address the distorting influence of concentrated wealth at the top through the expansion of existing progressive taxes and the exploration of a dedicated wealth tax. Now, where do we stand on that? There have been, I think in the UK, it may actually have passed some taxes on speculation, but where do we stand on those obviously low-hanging fruits where people that, you know, Wall Street has transgressed from creating wealth to extracting wealth, and much of what goes on is just about high-speed trading and all of these other non-productive forms of capitalism. Is there any way to tax them?
Absolutely. I mean, I think, and this is in some ways politically the most challenging, but it's really important to talk about it. We can tax financial transactions like they do in the UK. In the United States, a modest tax on stocks and bonds and transactions of derivatives and the like would generate anywhere from $200 to $300 billion a year. That money could be directed toward a wealth-building, asset-building opportunity fund. We already have an estate tax and our form of an inheritance tax, which is obviously still always under assault. Donald Trump wants to abolish it. It could be stronger. Some of the loopholes that the wealthy use to avoid it should be closed. And it could be graduated. It could be progressive, meaning that the most wealthy estates could pay a higher percentage. Again, that could generate hundreds of billions of dollars over 5 years that could be invested in turning this around and in creating opportunity. Debt-free college education fund. Those are the kinds of investments that would obviously make a huge difference. We don't have a net worth tax, a wealth tax, but that's the sort of thing, and Senator Sanders has talked about introducing that again, is to, you know, other countries do have an annual net worth tax. It's very, very small, and it only falls on billionaires, but it could be a real revenue raiser. It would both reduce inequality and it would create the money you need to invest to create opportunity for others.
Well, I thank you for your work, Chuck Collins. This is an important study. The ever-growing gap, failing to address the status quo, will drive the racial wealth divide for centuries to come. People can get that. How can they get hold of this report and start calling their congresspeople and making them read it?
The easiest place is to go to inequality.org. That's the website that I co-edit, and we do a little weekly newsletter for anyone who's interested. They can sign up there. And right on the homepage, you'll see the report Ever-Growing Gap, and the solution section and policy section has a lot of immediate things that we can do together.
And again, I've been speaking with Chuck Collins, who's a senior scholar at the Institute for Policy Studies, where he directs IPS's program on inequality and the common good, as well as co-founder of Wealth for the Common Good and the Patriotic Millionaires. His latest book is 99 to 1, How Wealth Inequality is Wrecking the World and What We Can Do About It. And he has a new report at the Institute for Policy Studies, The Ever-Growing Gap, Failing to Address the Status Quo Will Drive the racial wealth divide for centuries to come. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Bye.